Hey freaks, this is Vegan Freak Radio for the week of February 5th, 2007. We continue our interview with Professor Gary Francione of the Rutgers School of Law. On the show, we have more of your listener questions, and we talk about the roots of discrimination.
All forms of discrimination have their particular characteristics, but they share in common the commodification of the sentient other, and in that sense, they're all the same.
Professor Francione also discusses what he sees as the baseline commitment for any animal rights activist.
If you are an animal rights person and you're not a vegan, then you're not an animal rights person. And if you want to, like, get serious, become a vegan and then talk to me. But if you aren't a vegan, you aren't serious about animal rights.
We also discuss raising money through campaigns, comparing animal rights and civil rights, and the notion of burnout among activists. All this and more on part two of the Vegan Freak interview with Gary Francione. Our next question comes from Chris, and he says, I absolutely agree with your position on discontinuing the use of non-human companion animals, but caring for the ones that already exist. My question is this: what are some steps that we can take towards effecting incremental change on discontinuing the use of non-human companion animals?
Well, let me say, Chris's question actually, he prefaced it with saying a lot of nice things about me that were embarrassing. So,
Thanks, Chris.
I like you too.
We can read these if you want.
But let me say this. It's interesting. I wrote a blog several weeks ago about non-human animals and how we shouldn't bring any more of them into existence. That is a fundamental aspect of my theory. I mean, my view is that if we regard animals as being morally significant, then the next step is not to give them the same legal rights that humans have, because I don't think that legalizing the conflict is the right solution. The right solution is to care for the non-humans that we have now until they die, and we stop bringing any more into existence. The conflicts between humans and animals are ones we create. It is absurd that we bring these animals into existence to be used as resources for us, and then we sit around wringing our hands saying, oh, what are we going to do? What are our moral obligations? That is absurd. We have brought them into existence as means, exclusively as means to our ends, and then we sit around wondering about what our moral obligations to them are. I mean, it's absurd beyond all belief. The right way of dealing with the situation, it seems to me, is if we regard them as being morally significant, we stop using them altogether and we stop bringing them into existence. I wrote, now, of course, that's been my position for some time now, but I wrote a blog recently on animal rights and domesticated non-humans, and I have to say it has touched off a firestorm because I take the position, which I do, and I do not, I don't deny that I don't think we should bring dogs and cats and companion non-humans into existence anymore either. And let me say this. I have five dogs that Anna, Charlton, and I live with, and we adore them. We had seven. Two died. But that's the maximum number we've had of dogs. We've had seven dogs.
Seven, man.
That's a lot of work, let me tell you.
I know.
And because we take dogs. We take death row dogs, and we take dogs with medical problems. So we have deaf dogs, blind dogs, dogs that have, you know, all sorts of neurological problems and things like that. But there is nobody on the planet who loves dogs more than Anna Charlton and I. And if it were up to us, if there were two dogs left, and it were up to us whether they were going to continue to breed so that humans could have dogs, the answer is, are you kidding me? Of course not. They shouldn't exist. I love them, Anna loves them. I mean, they are our non-human children, but they shouldn't exist, and we shouldn't bring them into existence. And people have serious problems with their positions. As a matter of fact, of all the positions I take, the position that causes the most problems with animal people. I mean, there are two things I say that animal people go crazy about. One is when I say, I don't care if you're a vegetarian. I really don't care. Frankly, if you ain't a vegan, don't tell me you're serious about animal rights, because you're not. People get upset when I say that, and I maintain that. If you are an animal rights person and you're not a vegan, then you're not an animal rights person. And if you want to, like, get serious, become a vegan and then talk to me. But if you aren't a vegan, you aren't serious about animal rights, bottom line. And the other position that I take is that we ought not to have any domestic animals. We ought to stop bringing them into existence, and that includes companion animals. And people get very, very, very upset when I say that. And they say, well, you know, but what if we treat them nicely and blah, blah, blah. Well, obviously it's better to treat them nicely than to not treat them nicely, but they're still property.
That's right.
They're still things that we have. I mean, the bottom line is we love our five dogs, but if we wanted to keep them all in horrible circumstances and beat them and make them guard dogs and whatever we wanted to do with them, the law would protect that decision too. I mean, the law protects our decision to give them greater than property value, but the law would also protect our decision to treat them only as property. And the response I always get is, well, what if we changed, you know, what if we changed the status of dogs and cats and other companion animals, and they weren't property anymore, and we made them like, you know, we gave them a legal status similar to the status that we give to human children. And the answer is, well, you know, yeah, that might happen in another 5,000 years, but even then, it would be wrong to. We ought not to be bringing these animals into existence. They are for their entire lives, unlike human children, who are dependent on us for a period of time before they become independent of us. Non-humans are always dependent on us. They are dependent on us for their entire lives. When they eat, when they drink, when they go outside, they have to, you know, they have to be, you know, they have to make sure that when you know, Gary is doing a show with Bob and Jenna, that somebody is making sure that there's water in the bowl.
That's right.
Somebody is making sure that, you know, that they can go outside when they want to go outside. They are perpetually dependent. They are for their entire lives dependent on us. They are vulnerable. They live in this weird netherworld of, they're not animals, they're not living in the animal world, they're not humans, they're sort of stuck in this sort of weird, uncomfortable situation in which, you know, they're not really full members of our world, and they're not members of any other world either, and they're in this perpetual state of dependence and this perpetual state of vulnerability, and I think it is unfair, and I think it's not a good idea. Our five dogs, I think, are very happy, but there is no doubt in my mind that we ought not to be bringing these animals into existence and making them our pets. I don't care whether we treat them well or whether we don't treat them well. Obviously, it's better to treat them well, but it doesn't really matter whether we treat them well or not, or whether they're property or not. We've got no business bringing these creatures into existence for our companionship. We have each other for companionship. We have our species for companionship. We've got no business bringing them into our screwed up world. Absolutely not. I mean, you know, there's all these issues that are going on about, you know, I have arguments with people in, you know, in the animal community who say, you know, what do you do with cats? Do you let them wander? Do you let them go outside where they kill animals, where they get run over, where they get, I mean, you know, so I mean, it's crazy. We ought not to be in this situation confronting these situations. I mean, you know, do you feed your cat meat? Do you not feed your cat meat? I mean, you know, these are problems which we create by bringing these animals into existence. We ought not to be doing that. So I think the response to Chris's question is, let's take care of the ones we've got here. I feel very strongly we've got no business killing the ones that we have brought into existence through our stupidity, through our selfishness. We have no business killing them. And you know, this idea, you know, but we ought to be sterilizing these animals. No more reproduction. Take care of the animals that we have here, but no more. And what I've been getting since I posted that blog is an endless number of emails from people who are telling me that animals have a right to reproduce. I have to tell you something. I think that is just plain nuts.
I agree.
I do not think that animals have a right to reproduce, and I think that that makes no sense whatsoever. Let me give you an example, an analogy that I discuss in Introduction to Animal Rights. Let's assume that, I mean, we are getting very sophisticated scientifically, sort of, and we are now, you know, we are shortly going to get to a point where we can genetically engineer human animals who have adult strength but the intelligence of, you know, of two-year-olds, and we can get them to do all sorts of things, work in all sorts of environmentally hazardous situations that we don't want to have normal people working in. Let's assume that we do something monstrous like that, and we create this genetically weird group of people so that we can exploit them. And then let's assume that we come to the conclusion that that's a horrible thing, which it is. This idea that, well, we made a mistake, so we've got to let it continue going on and making the mistake. That's sort of like this whole discussion we're having about Iraq right now. We made a horrible mistake, but we've got to continue making the mistake. Indeed, we have to make it worse. I mean, that makes no sense to me. If we make a mistake, we acknowledge we make a mistake, and we stop the problem. And if we were to genetically engineer these mentally challenged people who were physically strong, if we were to do something monstrous like that and then recognize it was in fact morally monstrous, the solution is we stop perpetuating the problem. We don't say, oh, well, we brought them into existence, so now there's nothing we can do. We've got to let them reproduce and let them continue to exist. I mean, that is crazy. So the idea that, well, we screwed up, we domesticated animals, so we've got to continue domesticating animals, because they've got a right to reproduce, that is absolutely crazy. It is as crazy as saying, we made a horrible mistake in Iraq, so let's perpetuate it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I get really frustrated also by the people who defend killing animals in shelters, for example, and I guess I get bothered by that. I mean, for the obvious wrong of it, but also one of our dogs spent a year in a shelter before she came to us, and yeah. I think about our dog, and I think, you know, it's very personalizing to me. I think, you know, had our dog been in a kill shelter, she would not be alive, and all these dogs that are being killed, it's solving. I think what we're doing is taking the kind of shortcut out of solving the human problem of creating all of these animals by killing them. And I'm always bothered by animal advocates who defend that killing.
Part of the problem is that animal advocacy is unfortunately very cultish in a lot of ways, and so, you know, what you have these very large organizations. You have organizations like PETA that takes the position that trap, neuter, return work is a bad idea, and that we ought to capture all these cats and kill them, or that, you know, that we ought to kill every animal in a shelter, and, you know, the idea that there are no bad homes in heaven or whatever PETA thinks. But I agree with you completely. It is a humanocentric, hierarchical, and speciesist solution to the problem. We've created the problem. We have brought interest bearers into existence. We now have an obligation to deal fairly with those interest bearers until they die. But we shouldn't bring any more into existence, but I'm a big supporter. I have to tell you something. For the past several years, I've been giving all of my book royalties. I made the decision years ago that I would never make any money doing this. So I did all the legal work I did over the years, I did pro bono. And all of the royalties that I've made from books or any speaking fees I get go to various animal causes. And the thing that I've been promoting over the past several years are no-kill shelters, which I believe very strongly in. You know, some are better than others,
sure.
And it's very, very difficult. No-kill shelters, that's a difficult job to have.
It's
a difficult thing to do. But I'm a big believer in trap, neuter, return work. I mean, that's why I support Shel Sullivan and you know, the Animal Spirit, because, I mean, you know, she's out there, you know, doing, you know, TNR education and her own TNR work. I mean, that's hard work. And you know, particularly when you're doing it in a context where the largest animal organization in the United States, PETA, is busy opposing you mm-hmm. and saying you ought to kill all those animals. I mean, that's simply not right. I mean, the idea, whenever you get to a point where you say animal rights means dead animals, you got a problem with the concept.
Absolutely.
And you know, but...
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Why don't we move on, though? We have some other questions here. We have two questions from Ryan, and I think they're both really good, so I want to make sure we get to both of them. But I'll go in order because they're kind of different, but they both draw off of Lee Hall's recent book, Capers in the Churchyard. And Ryan says that he recently finished Lee Hall's Capers in the Churchyard and found himself disagreeing heartily with Hall's argument that we shouldn't rely on graphic footage to help convert omnivores to veganism. Rather, he writes, Hall argues we should attempt to convince them based on simple merits of the animals aren't ours to use argument. Hopefully, he says, he's not misstating Hall's statements, and he agrees that it would be nice to be able to simply convince people that we shouldn't eat animals. He thinks that the graphic footage initially grabbed so many people's attention, and it grabbed his attention. And he's wondering what your thoughts are on the use of undercover footage and exposés of the worst cruelties as a method to grab the public's attention.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I haven't read Capers in the Churchyard, and I haven't read it, so I don't know what she says or what she doesn't say. But, I mean, assuming that what Ryan is saying is accurate, I disagree with it. I mean, I certainly think that rational argument is very important. You know, you have to make it clear to people that, you know, and challenge them in the view that it's morally acceptable to use animals for human purposes, any human purposes. And so, you know, I certainly do that. I've done it every day of my life for the past 25 years. But I also don't see what the problem is with using graphic footage. I mean, I have to tell you something. I came to this. I was in law school, and a friend of mine took me to a slaughterhouse. And this is going back, I think, 19—it was a long time ago. It was probably 78, 79, somewhere around there. She took me to a slaughter. I mean, you know, I never thought about this issue in my whole life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to tell you something. My father was a meat dealer. He was involved in the restaurant business.
Wow.
It never occurred. I mean, the only relationship I had with animals was I ate them. That was my only relationship to non-human animals. We never had any non-humans growing up in the house because my brother was asthmatic, and we never had any animals. I didn't have a dog or a cat or anything like that. I mean, I had things like snakes and turtles and whatever, but I didn't really relate to animals in any way. And I went to a slaughterhouse, and it changed my perception of the world in a matter of an afternoon, basically. And I think that you know, the idea that we don't want to show people what goes on, and I think that's just dead wrong. I mean, look, you try to find on the web pictures of slaughterhouses if you want to use them in your animal advocacy. And you know what? It's hard to find them. It's very hard to find them. And why is that? The reason why that is because the slaughterhouses don't want you to know what goes on there. They don't want to reveal to the public what goes on there because it would horrify. I am firmly convinced, if most people, not all people, but if most people, if you took them to a slaughterhouse, to an egg battery, to a dairy farm, to most of the places where animals are exploited in institutionalized exploitation, people would be horrified, and very many of them would stop exploiting animals. This stuff is carefully shielded from our view. So I disagree completely with the idea that we shouldn't use graphic footage. I mean, I certainly think we ought to make, you know, we ought to be making rational arguments, and I'm a big believer of that. I've been doing it myself for a long time now, much longer than Lee Hall's been doing it. But I also believe, I can't see what the problem is with using graphic footage. I really can't. So I think that, you know, to the extent that, you know, for example, I think Gail Eisenitz is, you know, I don't agree with Gail's position. I mean, you know, Gail has a welfarist position that I don't necessarily agree with in a lot of respects. But I think her photographs of slaughterhouses are terrific, yeah. Are absolutely terrific. And I think it's important for people to see what they're participating in when they eat meat. And, you know, what they're participating in when they eat an egg, or what they're participating in when they drink milk or eat a cheese pizza or have an ice cream cone, mm-hmm. or whatever. I think it's important for people to see. So the idea that, you know, that graphic footage is bad, I'm not sure I even understand the argument. But as I say, I haven't read the book, and, you know, given the long number of things that are of interest to me that I will read, that I hope I can read before I die. I have to be honest with you, it's not high on my list.
Well, actually, I don't remember that argument from the book. I read it a long time ago. I think you would find a couple things in the book you'd agree with, so you should check it out at some point.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that there are some things that I would agree with. I mean, I'm sure that there are some things that I would agree with. I know that she makes a distinction between animal rights and animal welfare, and she criticizes animal welfare, but I did that 12 years ago. I came to that conclusion. But, I mean, I don't understand this business about graphic footage. Do you know what the argument is?
I don't remember that argument. I mean, like I said, I read the book a long time ago, but I don't remember the argument about graphic footage. The argument I most remember from the book was that the animal rights movement, quote unquote, needed a kind of third way, a way that shied away from welfareism, a way that shied away from kind of the imposed hierarchy of kind of violence and intimidation campaigns, and that we needed a kind of third route that forged a new way of thinking about how to approach these questions. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I mean, in Rain Without Thunder, I made very clear that violence wasn't a good idea and welfare wasn't a good idea, and that what we needed to was to pursue vegan abolition activism. So, I mean, I don't disagree with that.
Indeed. Well, Ryan had another question related to Leehel's book, and that sort of relates to another question from Karen. Ryan asks, in Leehel's book, Hall seems to imply that groups like Farm Sanctuary are exploiting animals in their own way by promoting things like Adopt a Turkey at Thanksgiving and using cute language to describe animals' stories. I have trouble finding too much fault in this approach because of the positive result it has on the public's view of animals and animal advocacy. What roles do you think sanctuaries and shelters should play in our movement? And then Karen asks also, what role should they play in educating children?
Well, I think, I'll say it again. I haven't read the book, so I don't know what Ryan, I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming Ryan is accurately characterizing Hall's position. But
he's a pretty smart guy, so I think he is.
Probably, yes.
Okay. Well, I don't see the problem. I mean, I don't know what cute means. I mean, cute's a funny word. I don't know exactly what it means.
Well, kind of personalizing them, anthropomorphizing animals, giving them kind of these names and turning their stories into these cute little things that people can follow. It kind of has a campaign mentality to it, and Hall does critique that in the book.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, as far as Farm Sanctuary is concerned, that's an organization I have been critical of for a while now, since they did their Down to Animal campaign, which I thought was really ill-advised, and I discussed that in Rain Without Thunder. I'm not exactly sure what she's referring to. I certainly don't think as a general matter. I mean, let me give you an example of what I think is excellent writing from a sanctuary about sanctuary animals. Let me go back to this peacefulprairie.org organization. Are you familiar with that group, by the way, Bob and Jenna?
Yes, we are.
Okay. There's a woman who's involved with that organization named Joanna Lucas, who writes stories on their blogs about their about the animals at the shelter. And I have to say, I think that her writing is some of the best stuff I've read in terms of, anthropomorphizing is a problem only to the extent that you attribute to non-humans characteristics which are human and not non-human. And I view non-humans as having a lot of characteristics that are very, very much in common with ours. And so I don't think of it as anthropomorphizing at all. I think the concept of anthropomorphizing is itself very speciesist, because we assume that animals don't have a lot of the emotional and intellectual attributes that we have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was a, as I say, I've only recently discovered Peaceful Prairie, and I started reading the stories on their blog, and Joanna wrote a story about a pig named Celeste, and I thought it was their New Year's blog, and I thought it was one of the most beautiful things I have read in recently. It was wonderful. Again, I confess, I don't read Farm Sanctuary stories. Farm Sanctuary as a group doesn't interest me. They're very, very welfarist. Mm-hmm. They promote whole foods. They promote things like the Downed Animal Act. They promote things like the foie gras ban in California. I mean, they promote a lot of welfare stuff that doesn't interest me at all. And I used to be a regular speaker at Farm Sanctuary events until I refused to come out and speak at their. They had an event celebrating the movie Babe, and I refused to to participate in that, and I was roundly criticized as being divisive and horrible and evil and Rasputin-like or whatever they thought I was, because I wouldn't participate in their babe fundraiser. And I took, I mean, I have a very simple black and white position on that, like I have about most things, and that is I don't support the use of, I don't care what the message of the movie is, I do not support the use of non-humans in movies under any circumstance. I don't care how good the message is, how bad the message is, it's irrelevant what the message is, I do not support the use of animals in movies. And I explained that to Gene and Laurie, and they got very upset with me because they wanted me to come out and participate in this thing, and that was sort of the end of that relationship. But I don't really sort of, Farm Sanctuary doesn't really interest me all that much, but I certainly think that sanctuaries are important. And I think with respect to Ryan's question and Karen's question and the role of sanctuaries in education, I'm so interested in Peaceful Prairie that as soon as this horrible season called winter lifts from the East Coast and from Colorado, where they're getting it really badly, yeah. I intend to go out there and see what the people at Peaceful Prairie are doing, because everything that I'm seeing coming out of that organization seems to me to be exactly what it is I'm talking about. These are people who aren't being equivocal. It's veganism, not vegetarianism, not being conscientious omnivores. They have stuff on that website about how free-range eggs are no better than other eggs, and how, you know, the solution to the egg problem is you don't eat eggs. I don't care how they're produced, you just don't eat them. But they take a vegan position, they're doing vegan education, and they're taking care of individuals. And they're very, very, I mean, they describe themselves as an abolitionist sanctuary. So, you know, that really intrigues me. And as far as I'm concerned, it is precisely that sort of organization that has the greatest potential for education. So the idea that, you know, we shouldn't describe the stories of these animals in ways that Lee Hall might find anthropomorphic, well, that's her problem. But my view is that the only reason why we regard this as anthropomorphism is because we aren't willing to understand that these animals are just like us, and they have the same emotional attributes and the same intellectual attributes, so they don't speak the same language. Who cares? But to say that it's anthropomorphic or cute is, in my judgment, to miss the point. So, well, no, I disagree with that.
I think one of the concerns, though, would be that it would be kind of another way of exploiting animals, right? You're using them, kind of creating these stories around them, using them to raise money for the kinds of new welfare campaigns or for the sanctuary itself. I think that was the concern. Not necessarily the...
Well, I mean, to the extent that you're new welfareist, it doesn't matter to me what you're doing, because I don't agree with new welfareism. So whether you're doing it by promoting downed animal acts, or whether you're talking about, you know, cute, whatever that means, stories about animals, I don't agree with it. But when I look at an organization like Peaceful Prairie and I say, well, wait a minute now, you know, these people are... I mean, I don't read. Maybe you read it differently. I mean, if you're familiar with them, maybe you have a different cut on this. But my view is, when I look at those stories, I see those stories, and those stories of those animals are pulling people in. As a matter of fact, I think
powerful.
Joanna Lucas has a real... are you familiar with her blog?
Well, I just started kind of paging through it. Man, they are very powerful.
That's exactly the word I would use. I would say powerful. I mean, I read that stuff, and I thought, this is a person who has an incredible, I don't know this woman, but I don't know who she is. I wouldn't know if she walked in my house right now, I wouldn't know her. But I can tell you, whoever she is, she has an enormous ability to understand the non-human other, much more so than the ethologists at Harvard, Yale, and, you know, any place else on the... I mean, you know, just an incredible... Again, I don't want to say anything about Farm Sanctuary, because I'll be honest with you. I mean, like Capers in the Churchyard, I haven't read that book, and I don't pay much attention to what
sure.
Farm Sanctuary says or doesn't say, and I don't participate in their activities anymore, and I don't really pay attention to them. So I don't know what they're doing, what they're not doing. And to the extent that they're using animals to raise money for new welfareist or welfareist campaigns, I don't believe in that. I think that's nonsense. But I do think that it's perfectly appropriate to sort of give people insights into into the emotional and mental life. I mean, Jeff Masson does that to some degree. I mean, you know, he has. I think that's fine. That's not anthropomorphizing. Anthropomorphizing is only a problem when you start attributing characteristics to non-humans that they don't have. And I think that's the problem, is that we just sort of miss the point that they do have these characteristics.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Speaking of raising money, though, Garden Variety, that's a forum user. Jenna?
Sorry?
I don't know.
Someone named Garden Variety, someone with the nom de plume of Garden Variety wants to know if abolitionist campaigns would raise enough money, or whether we actually need welfarist or new welfarist campaigns to raise money. Because we were just talking about, you know, raising money and using animals, and I thought this question would fit there.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that welfarist campaigns are counterproductive, so the fact that they raise a lot of money is irrelevant. The more money they raise, arguably the worse it is, because these campaigns only reinforce the property status of animals in the first place. So, I mean, the fact that they raise money, I don't really, yes, they do. Welfarist campaigns raise money, but think about it. That's logical, because they don't really challenge anybody. I mean, you know, when welfarist campaigns, which basically take the position that it's all right to, that it's all right to exploit animals as long as we do so humanely. Well, that's a position nobody disagrees with, and so, you know, obviously it's a big tent sort of position.
Sure.
But it's meaningless in terms of its content. And so the fact that it elicits, you know, that those sorts of campaigns result in a lot of money being raised. So what? I don't see the campaigns as helping anyway. The thing I think we've got to focus on is, abolitionist campaigns don't need a lot of money. I mean, these organizations need a lot of money because they're, you know, first of all, most of the people who are involved in these organizations, or many of the people involved in these organizations, not all of them, but a lot of them, are making a lot of money. I mean,
sure.
These people are making six-figure salaries. They have huge expense accounts. They have all their meals paid for. They have all their expenses paid for. I mean, at some point in time, I'm sure an investigative journalist will get into the finances of the movement. And when they do, they are going to be horrified. The public will be horrified to find out. I mean, some of this stuff is already known about some of these organizations, but
yeah.
I mean, these organizations are engaged in conduct which I think is scandalous in terms of the amount of money that people make and the benefits that they have and the number of family members that they have on the payroll and stuff like that. I mean, it's just scandalous. But abolitionist campaigns require very little money. I mean, first of all, the most important thing is becoming a vegan. That doesn't cost you anything. As a matter of fact, you save a lot of money when you're a vegan. But
that's,
I mean,
true.
You know, becoming a vegan is really cost-effective. And vegan, you know, people ask me, what do I mean by vegan education? The answer is, it's as unlimited as your imagination is. There's all sorts of things you can do. I mean,
yeah.
It's putting up billboards by the Denver Livestock Exchange, you know, with Go Vegan. It's going to your local community college and giving, you know, your adult education program, giving lectures on you know, animal rights and veganism and abolition and why people want to sort of get rid of this stuff completely from their lives. It's doing things like these people in Spain who are setting up every Sunday and giving out literature about veganism and the relationship of speciesism, sexism, racism, and homophobia. It's things like, you know, Anna Maria Boglio in Argentina. Are you familiar with Anna at all?
No, I don't. I don't know anything.
She's a very, very interesting person. Very, very interesting person. She's been doing this. She's been taking the abolitionist, you know, position now. I think she read Rain Without Thunder in the 90s, and it really turned her on. And she's really, you know, pushing forward with this. Very, very articulate, bright, very hardworking person. And she's basically got a small group down there, and she's promoting, you know, animal rights and abolition in Argentina. You know, you know, there are a lot of things people can do, and it's cost, you know, it's not all that expensive. I mean, I have a website. It's reaching a lot of people. And basically, I'm doing it with a former student, you know, a person who graduated a couple of years ago, and somebody who's very good with computers and with HTML. I sound like a computer person when
you
I
sound like a nerd now.
Well, with HTML. you know, who's very good with HTML and Flash and all of these other things, and he's volunteering time. And people like Karen from Germany, who's volunteering time to do translations, and my other translators, who are all volunteering time just because they're into the abolitionist thing. It's not costing us anything. I mean, it's basically not costing us anything. And we're busy reaching 700 people, 800 people, 900 people a day, you know, and it's not costing anything. So, you know, there are all sorts of things that we can do that are very, very cost effective. And I reiterate that if you want to support things, find local things to do. I mean, I think, you know, the sorts of things that you and Jenna are doing, you know, fantastic. You're doing more and reaching more and educating more people than these multi-million, zillion, trillion-dollar animal organizations. You're doing much more effective education, and you're reaching a lot more people with a coherent, consistent, you know, intelligent message. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, people want to support things, support what you're doing. They want to support things, support the trap, neuter, return work that people like Animal Spirit are doing. Support Peaceful Prairie. You know, support, you know, these organizations, these small local grassroots organizations, because ultimately that's where we're going to get the change. It's not going to be imposed by these corporations. You know, it's the way change happens, and you know this as well as I do. You're a sociologist. You understand this stuff, and you know that the way change happens, you don't impose change. Change comes from the grassroots. You know, I mean, change comes because people feel, because the moral paradigm shifts. And that's how change happens. It doesn't happen because you have people flying in. You know, I mean, I used to say this all the time when I was, you know, really actively involved on a day-to-day basis with the animal rights movement, is that, you know, as a matter of fact, when I first got involved with PETA, they had chapters. You know, they had chapters. This is a little known fact. PETA had chapters in different parts of the country. And Ingrid decided that she was going to close the chapters. And this was something I opposed, because I thought that the best way to spread the message was locally, and have local people working in local communities spreading the message. And that the last thing in the world we want, people flying in from Washington or people flying in from New York to, you know, various other places to tell people what the truth is, that never works. It has never worked. It's never going to work. The only way you change things is by changing things on a local level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard work.
Yeah, it is.
But that's the only way it works, people. That's the only way it works. And that's why I say, you want to. People ask me all the time, you know, who do I support? And I always say, look, you know, I'm not an advisor. I can't advise you as to who to give your money. I can tell you, I give my money to local people who are doing trap, neuter, return work. I give my money to local people who are doing no kills. I give my money to local people who are trying to get, you know, death row dogs adopted. I give my money to people who are doing sanctuary work, abolitionist sanctuary work. I give my money to people who are doing abolitionist education on a grassroots level, because that's the only thing that works.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about on our show fairly often is the idea that everyone, I mean, this sounds kind of like New Agey and a little flaky, but everyone is a unique and beautiful snowflake. You know, everyone does have some talent or some ability that they can bring to this cause. And I think everyone needs to recognize what that talent is. And it isn't just giving money. I think everybody has some ability to do something out there. And, you know, I really think that that's one of those vital things for people to do.
Well, Bob and Jenna, you know, one of the problems with modern animal activism is that these welfareist corporations have now convinced everybody that activism is taking your checkbook out and writing them a check.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And that is very, very, very counterproductive and dangerous. That's not, you know, people ought to be doing things themselves. You know, this idea, a number of people have been writing to me since I put up this website. A number of people have written to me saying, why don't you start an organization? And, be, you know, we need to have you as a leader. And I write to them all and say, the last thing in the world we need, more leaders.
That's right.
We are all, you know, if this is ever going to work, we need all of us to see ourselves as centers of change.
Absolutely.
Each of us needs to, you know, and the idea that we're going to look to somebody else to do that is absurd. And we can't do that. And that's what we've done already.
Mm-hmm.
We've ceded our you know, we've ceded the authority to these leaders of these national organizations. And activism has become, let me write a check to this group or to that group. And that's never going to work. We need to see ourselves as moral centers for change, each of us. And each of us is capable of affecting and influencing other people. And if all of us who care about this were to only be concerned about the people that we have immediate contact with and the people that we can have contact with in our communities, we would have a nonviolent, paradigm-shifting abolitionist revolution in a fairly short period of time. We just need to believe in that vision and do it and act on it and have the confidence to do something about it.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Indeed. And that's the beauty of the internet, like you were saying before. You can do more with less. It allows us to do amazing things at the grassroots level.
You know what? The two of you are professors at St. Lawrence. I'm a professor at Rutgers. None of us have a lot of resources, and here we are sitting talking on a blog, and you know what? This Vegan Freaks thing that you do gets out to 1.5 million people. I mean, I cannot believe the number of people who heard my interview with you in November. And you know, I mean, the responses are terrific. You're reaching a large number of people. And here we are, three academics. You know, I mean, think about it. And think about the power of that. And what we need to do is sort of turn everybody on to the whole idea of we're all centers. All of us are leaders. I hate that word. I don't like it. But all of us are centers. And what we need to do is to sort of only focus on, A, ourselves, become vegans. Like, you know, that's the primary thing. Each of us has to become a vegan. And then what we need to do is work on the people who are close to us. And if we all did that, my God, what a fantastic result that would be.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, I think what you talk about with the large organizations is we've ended up losing our own agency. We forget that we can do it. And that, to me, that is so frustrating because people often ask me, you know, what can I do? And I say, well, I don't know. What can you do? You tell me. So I think
we need
to remember that. And your words are very powerful, and I very much appreciate those. So why don't we change gears here for a second? A couple more questions to get through that I think are really good, and I want to make sure we get to them. Someone on our forum named End Cruelty, he wants to know if veganism is similar to a religion because it involves strict adherence to guidelines that require that we avoid animal exploitation. What are your thoughts on that?
Is it like a religion? I mean, look.
I don't think so, but, you know.
We have all sorts of absolute, I mean, you know, I'm absolutist about a whole bunch of things in my life. You know, I'm absolutist about child molestation. I'm absolutist about rape. I'm absolutist about animal exploitation. I'm a vegan. Nobody ever asks me if I have religious views about rape and about child molestation because I absolutely reject them. It's only when you get to animal issues and you say, well, look, you know, I'm absolutely opposed to animal exploitation, just like I'm absolutely opposed to various forms of human exploitation. I think in certain ways, I'm not saying that End Cruelty is speciesist. I'm saying that whenever I get the question, aren't you being absolutist? I always say yes, and proudly so, just like I am about various forms of human exploitation. And so the fact that I'm absolutist when it comes to animal exploitation, I don't see that as a problem. Not for me. It may be a problem for you, but I mean, to the extent that you say, well, your absolutism about animals is somehow problematic, my response is, well, that's because you think that discrimination on the basis of species is somehow not as serious as discrimination on the basis of other sorts of criteria relating to humans. And I don't rank evils. I don't believe in ranking evils. I mean, I simply don't. But all forms of discrimination have their particular characteristics, but they share in common the commodification of the sentient other, and in that sense, they're all the same. There are differences. Sure, there are differences, but they're all the same. And so my view is, hey, I don't like any of them, do I regard this as a religion? No more so than I regard my feelings about child abuse, or abuse of women, or abuse of anybody else, or discrimination against anybody else. I mean, one thing I think that is problematic, I think there is a cultish aspect. I'm sorry, but I believe that there is a sense in which the modern animal movement is very much a cult, in the sense that we don't have these discussions about these sorts of issues. I mean, you know, the three of us are having it on your podcast, and I have it with, you know, I have it with a variety of people, and you have it with a variety of people. But the bottom line is, these discussions don't go on at the level of the national organizations, because, you know, I mean, there is a movement in which, you know, you have people, you know, like Peter Singer, you know, who takes the bizarre positions. I mean, you know, that it's all right for us to exploit people who are mentally challenged, or that it's all right for us to have sex with animals as long as, you know, they consent to it, and we take them to dinner and a movie before we have sex with them, or whatever he says. And so you have Singer saying these in my judgment, bizarre things. You have Newkirk, who takes the position that animal rights is dead animal. The only good animal is a dead animal. You have these bizarre positions, and if you even question them, I mean, if you even say, "Gee, you know, I'm really, you know, concerned that, you know, people are articulating the positions that it's all right to have sex with animals under certain circumstances, or that, you know, that the only good animal is a dead animal, we ought to try to kill every animal we can because there are no bad homes in heaven," or whatever. If we even question these things, then we're being divisive and we're harming animals. I think that starts smacking of cult behavior.
Absolutely. I was going to say, recently we've been accused of our abolitionism being politically divisive, and I think it's an absurdity. I mean, it's just an absurd argument to argue that abolitionism is politically divisive. I mean, why is not welfareism politically divisive from the true?
But that's no different, though, than the argument that, you know, if you criticize what's going on in Iraq right now, you're giving aid and comfort
to
terrorists. That's right.
That's right.
If you disagree with us, you're a bad person.
Yep.
This is presently the level of discourse. If you disagree, then you're harming the thing you claim to care about. And I don't see the discourse in the animal. I mean, look, the two of you have been doing this a lot. You've come to it more recently than, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time now. If I had 5 cents for everybody who said my positions on animal rights were divisive, I would be able to retire now. because let me tell you, when I wrote Rain Without Thunder, in which I took the position that the rights position was different from the welfare position, and that the rights position was in danger of collapsing into the welfare position. What's happened since I wrote that book is it has collapsed into the welfare position, but that's what I was arguing in 96.
Sure.
When I wrote that book, I actually received hate mail, including death. You know, I mean, I received some very nasty mail from, quote, animal people, end quote, who were very angry that I criticized PETA and Farm Sanctuary and all these other groups, you know, because I disagreed with their positions. Again, I never went after anybody personally. I just said, look, you know, I disagree with these positions. I think that PETA's position on sexism is wrong. I think their position on killing healthy animals in sanctuaries is wrong. I think Farm Sanctuary's position on the Downed Animal Act is wrong. And I didn't get, like, you know, letters explaining to me why I was wrong. I was just told, you disagree, you know, you should never, ever express disagreement. I mean, I remember there was an instance that came up in the 90s where Cleveland Amory, who was the Fund for Animals, and Cleveland Amory headed Fund for Animals. He's now gone, but he's not dead, but Fund for Animals had a sanctuary in Texas that was being run by a guy who was involved in the meat business. And there were all sorts of concerns about the fact that these animals in the sanctuary were giving birth to offspring that were being slaughtered and things. I mean, there were all sorts of problems. And I remember, you know, there was a Village Voice article that came out about the Black Beauty Ranch in Texas that was run by Fund for Animals. And I mean, it was well known within the movement that, you know, there were all sorts of problems with that. And those of us who criticized, I being one of them, what was going on at Black Beauty, were criticized by the movement for, we should never air our dirty laundry in public. And my response was, well, isn't that exactly what we criticize the vivisectors for? That, you know, when we find something wrong, you know, when we find that there's some vivisector who's doing some horrible thing, all the vivisectors rally around, you know, the guy who's done the bad thing, and we criticize them for doing that. Aren't we doing the same thing? And, you know, and I think that, you know, we really do need to have discourse about these things, but we're not allowed to. And in a sense, you can understand understand it. I mean, it's an opportunity cost that most of these organizations don't want to incur. I mean, you know, to have these discussions, I mean, just gets in the way of their fundraising.
Sure.
So they don't want to have these discussions, so they don't. But, you know, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be having these discussions, because we need to be having these discussions. So let me just tell the two of you now, if if you think that you've been called divisive, get used to it, because you're going to get called divisive a lot more.
I'm fine with it. No problem.
Yep.
You know what I say? I'm divisive and proud.
Yeah, we got to live what we believe. So
absolutely, and you know, I'm not in this thing to make friends. That's how
you
I feel.
I mean, you know, it's not that I particularly enjoy making enemies, because I don't. I'm actually a very whatever people think, I'm a very friendly guy. But but when people like Newkirk say, well, you know, I just don't understand why Gary, you know, why he has to disagree so much. Why can't we just all work together? And the answer is because we're doing different things.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. My vision is very different from Ingrid's vision. And it's not a question of, you know, why don't we all work together? Why don't we all bury the hatchet, forget the differences, and work together? The bottom line is we can't, because we're doing something very, very different. Just like if you go back to 19th century America and you look at the abolitionists and the regulations with respect to human slavery, they did not see themselves as working toward this. You know, they didn't see themselves as the same group. The people who were in favor of abolition were not willing to support humane regulation of slavery. Similarly, you know, they didn't see themselves as involved in the same enterprise. I do not see myself as involved in the same enterprise as Peter Singer. I see him doing something completely different. When he's talking about being a conscientious omnivore, I see him as involved in a fundamentally different enterprise from the one I'm involved with. It's not that I wish him any harm. I don't. I don't wish Newkirk any harm or anybody else any harm. That's not the point. The point is I just disagree with them, and what I'm involved with is a completely different enterprise.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That. Go ahead.
Yeah, that relates to actually one of our next questions. We had two questions from someone named Dan, and he asks, what is the difference between you and someone like Singer and Reagan?
That's a long answer.
Yeah.
Well, that's a long answer. I've written a lot about that, and you know, you can read stuff I've written about that. As a matter of fact, the Personhood of Animals, the book I have coming out from Columbia, addresses that to a considerable degree. And I have an interview coming out in Britain, the Vegan Society is doing, that discusses that. But let me just give you a short answer. I distinguish between use and treatment. That is, I think those are two separate issues. Whether we use animals and how we treat them are separate issues. For example, whether we use animals for food at all is a different question from how we treat those animals. So I distinguish the issue of use from the issue of treatment. And my view is we don't have a justification for using non-humans, irrespective of how humanely we treat them. I mean, obviously, it's better to treat them better than treat them worse. I mean, if you're going to commit a murder, it's better to murder somebody and not torture them. But that doesn't mean that murder is all right. And I draw this distinction between use and treatment and say, I don't think we have a moral justification for using them. And for me, the issue of treatment is very much a secondary issue. For Peter, he does not view, and again, I mean, you know, I'm compressing a lot of stuff in a short answer, but with the exception of animals like the great apes that Peter thinks are, which is why I think GAP is a problem and why I think GRASP is a problem, because it sort of regards non-human primates as being special or something. But people like Singer view non-human apes as having an interest in life and being different. But by and large, Peter, like Jeremy Bentham, the 19th century philosopher who Peter traces his theory too, Peter and Bentham don't believe that animals have an interest in living. They don't care. An animal doesn't care. I mean, non-human primates might, but all the other animals that we exploit don't really care whether we use them. They only care about how we use them, which is why Peter is able to say that, you know, if we can be conscientious omnivores and we can really treat animals well, it would be okay to eat them. because he doesn't really think that animals have an interest in living at all. Now, I disagree with that. I think that that's crazy. I think that if you're sentient, by definition, you have an interest in continuing to exist because sentience is a means to the end of existence. So I think that there's a fundamental theoretical problem with Singer's views. But the bottom line is, Singer doesn't think that use per se is problematic. He thinks that the primary issue is treatment. Reagan, there are a lot of, I mean, Reagan believes that in order for an animal to be a member of the moral community, the animal's got to be what he calls a subject of a life. And that, although he's not quite clear on that, that seems to suggest that an animal's got to have cognitive characteristics that go beyond mere sentience. And I think Tom is wrong about that. I think that if you're sentient, if you're subjectively aware, that's all you need to be a full member of the moral community. Reagan, I think, thinks that you need to have cognitive characteristics that go beyond mere sentience. And as support for that interpretation of Reagan, Tom believes that non-humans have that for non-humans, death is a lesser harm than it is for humans. And I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that means. I mean, I think that for all sentient beings, death is a harm. I may not understand what, you know, how a non-human interprets death, because language is so. But that's a problem of my epistemological limitation. That's a
sure.
problem mm-hmm. of my limitation. I'm limited. I can't understand. I may not understand what death means to a dog, but I certainly know that the dog regards death as a harm. And to say that death is a lesser harm for non-humans than it is for humans because death forecloses more opportunities, because Tom's view is that death forecloses more opportunities for humans than it does for non-humans. That strikes me as being very elitist, because it would suggest that, well, you could also say that death forecloses more harm for intelligent people. I mean, it forecloses more opportunities for intelligent people than it does for less intelligent people. So more intelligent people matter more than less intelligent people. I mean, I find that sort of elitism or perfectionism to be deeply troubling in Reagan's theory. I would also add this. I'm a little confused about what it is Reagan believes, because on one hand he says that he believes in abolition. On the other hand, you know, at his conference last year, The Power of One, which celebrated the, you know, the ability of the individual to help the oppressed, his keynote speaker was John Mackey from Whole Foods. and I have to tell you, that just, like, puzzles me incredibly. But in any event, this person, Dan, had another aspect of his question, didn't he, about civil rights, Jenna?
Indeed. He asks, why isn't animal welfare like civil rights? That is, the civil rights movement sought to make incremental improvements in rights for minorities. Why can't we see animal welfare doing the same thing?
Because, I mean, that's an excellent, excellent question. Again, unfortunately, it's a complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
The short answer is because animal welfare has nothing to do with rights, and it's really not a good analogy. Look, civil rights, when we talk about civil rights, we're not talking about slavery or human property. We're dealing with the civil rights, the discussion about civil rights deals with persons who have rights, and the issue about civil rights is whether we ought to make incremental additions to give right holders more rights. The problem is animals are property. They're like slaves. And animal welfare regulations are not incrementally adding rights to animals, but animal welfare regulation, what it does is it makes the exploitation of animals more efficient. It doesn't add to the rights that animals have, because animals don't have any rights. They're property. Animals don't have any, they're not persons. They don't have any inherent value. They are only their property that has only extrinsic or conditional value. Animals have the value that we accord to animals as a result of our greater or lesser largesse, but animals don't have any inherent value. They only have extrinsic or conditional value. And as a result, animal welfare regulations basically involve making animal exploitation more efficient. And, I mean, let me give you an example. You have the Humane Slaughter Act, which says you got to stun animals unless it's for, you know, unless they're in kosher or halal slaughterhouses. You have to stun animals before you shackle and hoist them. Animals have all sorts of interests. Why is it that we protect the interests of animals, you know, that we require that they be stunned in some circumstances, not in all circumstances? Why do we respect that particular interest? The answer is clear, because if we don't stun them, they'll jump around a lot when they're shackled and hoisted, and these are 2,000-pound animals, and they're gonna knock into workers, and they're gonna have bruised carcasses, and they're gonna cause worker injuries, etc. So we respect the interests of animals in being stunned before they're shackled and hoisted and stuck with the knife, because to do so gives us an economic benefit. But there are all sorts of interests that animals have that we don't respect because we don't get an economic benefit from respecting those interests. And my whole thesis about animal welfare, going back to the stuff that I started writing in the early 90s, is that animal welfare basically respects animal interests only to the extent that it's economically beneficial for humans. It doesn't result in animals having rights, and it doesn't move us closer to rights. What it does is it makes exploitation more efficient. The whole point of Rain Without Thunder, Chapter 7 in Rain Without Thunder that I alluded to before in the context of talking about Denayer, is I was saying that if you want to seek regulation, which I wasn't advising people to do anyway, you should at least seek regulation that incrementally moves away from property status. Mm-hmm. But that, because basically traditional animal welfare does nothing but make exploitation more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't move away from the property paradigm. What it does is it helps property owners to act more rationally with respect to their property. So to talk about civil rights, talk about animal welfare as analogous to civil rights, it's not an appropriate analogy, because civil rights, we're not talking about slaves. I mean, we certainly treat a lot of people horribly.
Yeah.
But most of us don't think that chattel slavery is a good idea. We're talking about people that we've already recognized are not chattel property and that are moral persons. And then the question is, making incremental changes to make sure that they are treated equally with respect to others and adding to their rights package. When we're talking about animal welfare, we're not talking about regulations which add to the rights package of non-humans, because the non-human animals don't have any rights. They are property. They don't have any rights. So I think that the analogy doesn't work.
This is a question that we have from Amber. Amber originally sent us a voicemail, left a voicemail for us, but because of my technical screw-up, we can't play it. But the gist of her question is about burnout. She wants to know, Gary, do you ever get burnout? If you don't get it, how do you avoid it? And generally, do you have any reflections on the whole idea of burnout among activists within kind of the quote-unquote movement?
Well, yeah, I have some reflections on it. I have been doing this for 25 years now. I started doing it basically around 1981, 82. And so I've been doing it for a while. And my view is this. I'm not the one in the factory farm. I'm not the one in the slaughterhouse. I'm not the one in the laboratory. I'm not the one in the fur farm. I'm not the one stuck in the trap. I'm not sure I've got a right to burnout, I guess. I think that a lot of animal people focus a lot on their own suffering. I've seen this over the years. I have seen this happen a lot, where animal people focus a lot on their own suffering. I think we need to move away from that. I think we need to recognize that you know, it's the world is a depressing place in a lot of ways. There are a lot of horrible things going on. It's not just animal oppression. I mean, you know, even if you don't care about animals, you know, the things that go on with respect to humans are pretty upsetting.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, you know, there are children starving. There are, there are people in horrible situations. Humans in horrible situations all over the world. You know, in poverty, in various forms of oppression, and it's dreadful. And there are certainly billions of animals that are suffering. And so I think, you know, you need to make a decision, and that is, if you care, you do something about it, and if you don't care, you don't. And if you do care and you do something about it, you always have to Put it in perspective and remember, you're not the one who's suffering. You may suffer indirectly, and I don't want to minimize that, but the humans and the non-humans who are being oppressed are suffering a hell of a lot more. And I think that we need to make sure that we don't indulge our second-level suffering too much. And so, no, I've been doing it for 25 years, and I'm grateful that I'm able to do it. And I live in a world of incredible violence, which goes back to the first question you asked me, how I feel about violence. I hate violence. I'm violently opposed to violence. I live in a violent world. I live in a world full of people who think that violence is okay, and that or that violence is a good reaction when violence is imposed on them. And you know, we need to at some point break this idiotic cycle of violence and say no, just stop participating in it altogether, which I believe we do. The most important first step we make in that respect is by becoming vegan. That is an extremely important fundamental step in the road toward ahimsa or nonviolence, is to stop exploiting them in our own lives. As I've often said, veganism is more than just a matter of diet or what you wear. It's applying the principle of abolition to your own life, and so I think that's really important. And I think, you know, it's a sad world we live in, but you know, as a friend of mine once said to me, "Otro mundo es posible." Another world is possible, but we have to visualize it. We have to believe in it. We have to work toward it, and we have to realize that we are fortunate to be able, and we have to see ourselves as privileged to help the people who are themselves struggling. We don't struggle. We're not struggling. We're trying to help those who are struggling. And that is a privilege and a great gift. And we need to see it that way and to not see ourselves as the ones who are, you know, sort of, you know, we're not the ones in the slaughterhouses. We're not the ones living under, you know, in oppressive and cruel situations, certainly not relative to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think we ought to avoid indulging that view.
I guess as a follow-up to that, I mean, even if you don't, even if you recognize that we're not the ones that are suffering, how do you not get overwhelmed by the vast amount of it that goes on in the world?
I don't have a choice. I mean, look, you know, it's horrible. I mean, you know, I'll tell you something. Since you've asked the question, I'll answer it. There are very few material things I own that I really care about. And one is a ring that I have that I wear, and it's a coin. It was minted by Mark Antony to pay his armies and navy at the Battle of Actium, which occurred in 31 BC. He lost that battle, and he and Cleopatra went back to Egypt, where they killed themselves. And I don't often explain why I wear this ring, but I'm going to explain it to you, so now the world knows. I wear it because it reminds me that if it ever gets too oppressive, I always have the choice of killing myself. And so I don't. You know, I mean, I have a choice. And I choose to stay here and to struggle and to regard. I mean, it's all a question of how you look at it. And I look at it as a privilege. I look at it as, you know, tomorrow morning I hope I will get up and have the privilege of being able to continue to do the work that I'm doing to play my small role in shifting the paradigm. You know, I have the choice. I could exit the world anytime I want. I choose not to because I choose to continue to view it as a privilege. Yes, it's horrible, Jenna. Of course it's horrible. It's absolutely hideously horrible. But what can you do? What are your choices? You either give up and crawl under, you know, a rock and die, or You say, I'm gonna struggle, and I'm gonna try to figure out, you know, a different way of looking at this. And you know, the sad thing is that the world could be a really wonderful place. And all we've got to do is will it as such. It's not a question. I mean, it's a question of will. It's a question of vision. And it's a question of whether we really want it. Do we really want it? And I sort of view my role in life as trying to stimulate people into wanting it. And I know there are a lot of people out there who do. And I say, let's work together. Let's do it. Let's shift that paradigm. And let's move it away from patriarchy. Let's move it away from violence. And what will come from that is moving it away from speciesism and sexism and racism and homophobia and all of the idiotic things that small minds have produced in order to create divisions. All of that's unnecessary. It's all silly. It's all stupid. It's all indefensible. And it could all be gone tomorrow if we willed it to be such. And that's what we have to do.
I couldn't think of a better place to call it to a close.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Jenna's almost crying.
No, it's very moving.
And it is.
It's, like you said, it's important to remember you're not alone in the struggle. So.
No, you know what? And there's people, I mean, you know, the three of us are talking, we've been talking for, you know, 3 hours and plus, and we obviously share a very similar vision of the world. We probably have some differences, but you know what? My guess is that the differences are minimal relative to the similarities. And you know what? There's a zillion people out there. We haven't been able to talk to each other because communication has been impossible. But now communication is not impossible. And there are going to be a lot of like-minded people. Yes, there are going to be people who are going to listen to this who aren't going to be convinced and say, it's all right for us to breed dogs and cats. I love my dogs and my cats. What's wrong with that? Or there are going to be people who are going to say, you know, whatever. But there are also a lot of people who agree. And what we need to do is all focus on that agreement and on the common areas of agreement, move forward and try productively and creatively to teach everybody we can about nonviolence, about veganism, and about abolition. We can do this. We can do this. But we need to, you know, it's not easy, but so what? You know, nothing really worthwhile is all that easily accessible, I guess.
Good point.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank the two of you for this opportunity and to be able to talk to the marvelous people who are subscribers to Vegan Freaks. And I love all you freaks. You're terrific, and I love these questions. And I encourage, you know, you people keep writing to me, and that's fine. And even, you know, if you disagree with me, that's even better. And, you know, argue with me. Tell me what you disagree with, and let's talk about it. And I really appreciate and very, very grateful for this opportunity.
We're grateful to have you on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and always incredibly enlightening. You're so articulate about these issues, and it's just impressive. It's a model for me.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope that I talk with you again. And
absolutely.
As I say, I really encourage your listeners to, you know, write to me, and you know, if you got things you want to talk about, talk about them.
And while we call it to a close, I just want to remind people that your website, they can go to your blog at garyfrancione.blogspot.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Also put a link to your new animal, the site where you have all the flash animations and the information on your abolitionist theory. And I'll put up links to Peaceful Prairie and a couple other things we've talked about throughout the show. So I want to thank you again. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy all the snow up there in upstate New York.
Will do.
Thanks once again to Gary Francione, and hope everyone enjoyed this part of our interview. As always, you can contact us several ways. You can go to our website, podcast.veganfreak.com. You can send us email, podcast@veganfreak.com. And you can always send us a voicemail, 267-295-1944. That should be on your refrigerator door. And thanks once again, everyone, for listening. Hope you have a great week. Yeah.
In a few moments, you can come up and pet the turkey if you want to.